Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room today, Jane Stroll is speaking on being ecumenical in the neighborhood. So let's listen in on Jane Stroll.
Talk with you a little bit about some strategies of where you might go from here if you're interested. What I've talked about the process of reception, as they call it, the concern for persons in the ecumenical affairs ambit about how do the things that they discuss and settle get down to be lived out in the lives, particularly of congregations and persons in communities. I would say some of the greatest pressure about ecumenical understandings comes precisely from people in families where there are mixtures of traditions, where the bottom line question is, we would like to be able to commune together. When is that going to be possible? You know, how can that happen? So I thought a lot about how ecumenism, we make some general statements, but just like all kinds of congregational practices, they're particular to the place where you live, to what this community looks like. The ecumenical opportunities, for example, in Seattle, are going to be quite different from what they are in, I'm trying to think where some of my students have taken calls in North Dakota. Rugby, North Dakota. There's one. I mean, it's going to look different. It's going to look different. Arena, I'd really be happy to hear from those of you who maybe have some experience in the communities in which you live. I'm going to draw off some specific pieces. That's why I say they may not be applicable to every setting, but they're things that pastor friends of mine have done. Or let me say, one of my great examples, my best friend from seminary is in a parish in a suburb of Chicago, in Cicero, actually. And I have laughed about the fact I look at us as having sort of a team teaching ministry, because we have remained very closely in contact since the years we graduated. And she was first in a kind of a suburban parish, and then her second call is in this, it's just a crazy place. I mean, Cicero is a very strange, it's economically, the big industries that were there have closed down. There's been tremendous turnover, huge influx of Hispanics. Cicero, as you may know, has an incredible reputation for racism. She said one of the great jokes, it seems to her, is that while these people were so busy keeping black people out, hordes of Hispanic people came in, which is, she said, so you're going to have to deal with something different anyway, right? Chicago, at the same time, it's blue collar. It was a very stable community that's become very transitional, lots of marginal people. So many of the things that I teach and think about, I test with her. I mean, the parish to me doesn't get more real than hers. And she used to tell me that she thought ecumenical stuff in some ways was a luxury for, she just didn't have time for it where she was. And she's in a primarily, the largest churches around her, of course, Roman Catholic in the Chicago area, as well as some big Pentecostal ones. Well, she has, as she put it, kind of fallen into ecumenism and has given a whole new dimension to her ministry and the life of her community. And so I will draw off some of those pieces in particular, and some things from the Twin Cities where I now live. At the very first time I talked about this, I mentioned if you're going to study denominations or church communities, there's sort of three areas you have to look at. The one that the formal dialogues do is theology and doctrine. Obviously, confessional statements, the way they talk about scriptural authority, the way they talk about the sacraments, we've addressed some of that. But if you think that knowing that material, you know a religious community, you're wrong. I gave as an example then, most of us, I mean, my parents, I think, are good Lutherans, but my parents would never have sat down with their Roman Catholic friends and said, you know, what really makes us different is Article 4 of the Augsburg Confession. Do you know, this is how we talk about justification.
Do you think that the regular church-going person really knows that, or do they just go to...
Yes, they don't know. I think they don't know that. I'm not saying that I think they should either. The job of, I think when people talk about justification by faith, when I talk about it to my parents, they don't go, huh? You know, I mean, it makes sense for the kind of preaching and teaching they've heard, that this is the way grace is active in their lives. But the most immediate ways they experience in themselves as different from some of their other Christians, brothers and sisters, wouldn't be articulated doctrine. It would be in the practices of piety and worship, which of course are influenced by doctrinal matters. But those are the things they'd know right away were different. We went to a Presbyterian church where they celebrated pew communion, and your father got up and started to go forward. You know, or my mother saying, you know, we did it again. We went to a Roman Catholic wedding, and the only part we really knew enough that it was the Lord's Prayer, and we prayed too long. They stop earlier. And the bride threw her bouquet at a figure of the Virgin Mary. Why did she do that, Cain? You know, I mean, now, that, and those are the kinds of...
Mary needed a husband.
Yes, that's right. That's right. She's not... It was an easy catch. No one would compete. That... You know, I mean, but those are, and they open up questions. Yes, thank you. I didn't say that to my mother, Leanne, but one of the reasons we get along well is I thought that as well. Well, Mom, if there's any woman in the congregation right then who obviously needed a husband. But I think, so those, these areas of worship practices and piety, I mean, one of the things... I spoke to a Roman Catholic high school class. I had a Roman Catholic student in my history class from the seminary, in the Roman Seminary in St. Paul. And he taught at a big parochial school and asked me to come speak to his high school classes in their religion class. He said, I think it would be especially good for the girls. You know, I mean, just to see a woman, he said, just for them to see somebody active in the faith and who is this thing, is Lutheran that I talk about. And one of the things that was really striking was they were like, well, how would it look different? What do you do differently? And I said, you know, Protestants, if they do family devotions or personal devotions, usually will read the Bible. And this is not to say Catholics don't read the Bible, but the role that the Missal plays, you know, a certain kind of said, those are the things you'll notice will be different.
But I think there's a regional difference too.
Yes.
I think in the West, Catholics would
the Bible. Yes. Well, it was interesting to hear the mix with these students, or that they use both, or that they, oh, well, we do that too. And then we use these prayers. Well, what prayers do you say? So those are the pieces. And the other thing, a good point, is it's changed over time. And one of the really important things, I think, in ecumenism is not to be so sure you know what you think you know about what another tradition is like or what it did. Because, for one thing, it may have looked a certain way where you grew up or where you live now, or how it looked 25 years ago when you... Or from parish to parish, right? So there are all those variables. But as I say, those are the pieces. And then the other piece we note is the differences in polity, the way the community is organized. No, you probably don't see, I mean, will not see publicly, although I have been to Roman Catholic masses where people are praying the rosary through it. But I have noticed it seems to be of a certain age. Yeah, right. So those are the places, I think, where we first note our differences. And we're curious. Why do you do that? Why, you know, what does that mean? And so I'd suggest to you that the place really to start, in many ways, the ones you talk about theology and doctrine. You can talk about teaching. You can learn something about how these different communities think about pieces of Christian teaching and how they fit into the way they worship, or the way we talked about baptism yesterday. Whether you would baptize an infant or baptize an adult believer, both communities would say this is a critical piece to what it is to be Christian in our community. It's different. And then, clearly, worship practices and piety. I mean, to get a handle on those. And it's not that much different than... I mean, I remember I was an exchange student when I was in college, and I had a roommate from Italy. We were studying German together, and when that torture was over, she invited me to come down to her home in northern Italy. And I remember sitting at the table and thinking, my gosh, these people cut up their fruit. I mean, they have fruit, they cut up apples and things and they eat them, and I thought, well, I probably shouldn't just pick it up and go, you know, which I would do at home. So I tried to cut my apple and I shot it across the table and hit her father. And I decided perhaps on the next occasion I would just put it in my mouth like a suckling pig. But all I'm saying is that what I realized then is, see, I was fascinated. Why do you do it? Why would anybody bother to cut up an apple? Sort of, why do you do that? How do you learn to do that? And that the customs, I mean, there are many ways you could look at the practices of our liturgy and say, these are the customs of this house. These are the customs of this table. There are ways you do things here at Holden that you won't do them at home. You know, and just on that level, and I think it's all the difference. We talked about sort of general snittiness. You know, you can kind of go with the flow and be open to it. You can spend the whole time saying, well, that's not the way we do it, which is only stating the obvious. And so I mean, I think right there, it's that ability to let go. I remember my mother and father went to India. My father is 6'4". My mother is 5'2". He spent all his time in major cities afraid he would never see her again. That if she started to go in the wrong direction, the crowds were such that she would just be gone. And he said, Jane, you can't imagine what it was like. I have never seen so many people in my life. And after the people came the sacred cows. You'd be standing in a stall and you'd turn around and there'd be a cow. And I said, how did you deal with it? He said, you know, it's one of the first times in my life I just let go. I just let go. I knew I didn't really have, at that point, the wherewithal to make sense of it. I just took it in and I held on to your mother. You know? And he said, and now I'm working on pieces about what that experience was like. For a long time afterwards, they went to see my brother, who was there studying at the time. He said, I asked Ralph questions, but I asked, my sister-in-law is from India, they visited, I asked questions. You know, what was that about? He said, and if I thought they might be offensive ones, I asked your brother first. To find out, was that some, but generally curiosity is a compliment. You know, and the tone of it, and I think that ability in some ways to walk and say, wow, just for a while, nobody is asking you to make a judgment whether this is truly the gospel, if there's heresy going on here, you know, all the, you're not going to get tainted, you know? It's all right, just take it in. And then sort those pieces out, and that the hospitality is there. So I'll offer these things we talked about, action reflection models. It always helps to know. So, I mean, my parents read some books before they went, so they had a clue as to what they were coming up against. I think that it's always helpful to do some of the background reading, kind of the thing you do if you're going to apply for a job, a teaching job. You do look at the catalog to find out who else is there, what their curriculum looks like. You know, just if you're going to meet somebody for the first time, you often will, especially like if you're being fixed up, well, tell me, you know, does he like, you know, just so that just a little bit of comfort level for you. And one of the things I have found fascinating reading, when I would try to get some basic things, not just for my students, but believe it or not, you act like you know it all, but you don't. And you teach lots of things you haven't a clue about. Where do you start? And one of the pieces I have found great reading is to get from the publication house or the educational curriculum group or whatever of the denomination or church, what do they present to people who are coming into their community? As an historian, two pieces, you have a twofold job. First of all, just trying to figure out what happened. But as most of us know, there comes a point where it really doesn't matter what happened. It matters how people tell their story. What do they think it meant? What issues come to the fore for them? What, and there is really, these to me were great pieces to read. Because here, as potential, I mean, as new members, oftentimes people who either didn't know their history or were choosing to make it their history. If you join this community, this is the story you now tell as your own. And so I would say that would be one piece, and they usually are, they're the kind of reading you can do with a busy life. You know? And they'll give you both a picture of the past, and they'll give you a picture of the present issues and a sense of the changes the community has gone through. So I found that particularly wonderful with Mennonites. I read some interesting Mennonite pieces. Another group, St. Vladimir's Press, out of St. Vladimir's Seminary in New York, wonderful material on Eastern Orthodoxy. Basic theological material, things on icons. You know, now, how to get hold of them? Well, this is the kind of thing I think you can throw into the lap of your pastor. Also, if you have a library committee, say, could we get some of those things to have here in the church library? You know, that's me interested. What do they say? I'll tell you another great one. You know, the Roman Catholic Church has just put out a new catechism. I think all of us ought to have that in our libraries. A copy of this, the new edition of the Book of Common Prayer. Get hold of hymnals. That's another interesting piece. What do they sing? What kinds of services do they have? What kinds of services do they have that you don't have? Do they do a foot washing? You know, do they? So those would just be pieces kind of to pique your curiosity and maybe have you focus, gee, I'd like to know more about this, that, or the other thing. In terms, I'll tell you another piece, not only how they tell their story to those who are taking that story on as their own, but it's really interesting to read other people's history and say, are we in this? And how do we figure in this? One of the most fascinating things for me was, this was an actual piece, an autobiographical piece written by an Anabaptist in the latter, about 1560, when he became disillusioned with it. And I remember, as I was reading this for the first time, and he's talking about how, you know, the community, they just divided and divided. Everybody had their own spirit, and if you had to do it my way, and if you didn't, we called you anathema and walked off. And he said, and here for so long we thought, as long as we weren't Lutheran or Zwinglian, we were safe. And I remembered reading that and thinking, we were somebody's enemy. We were somebody's defined over against. So, and the other interesting thing is, what does it mean if you don't show up in their history at all? Right. So that's just, how do they see us in the panoply of where they came from? Yeah, please, Leanne.
In the late 60s, early 70s, I remember walking into the Baptist campus ministry at my college and finding a whole rack of brochures on how to convert a Lutheran, how to convert a Roman Catholic, how to convert a Mormon, how to convert, and they were all done by the Southern Baptist Press. I can't remember what it's called. But I read all of those. It was really fascinating to see what they thought we were lacking.
Yes.
And what they thought our weak points were.
And how they might appeal to us.
Strategize to convert any of these denominations, people from these denominations to Southern Baptists.
And what's striking, too, is even to look at the kind of language that's used. People still talk about converting others. And one of the things that I look for now when I read these is, do they have a section on ecumenism? What do they say about it? Right? So that could give you a sense of the ethos. Now, in terms of actually doing things in the community, probably the best way that ecumenism happens is when people just have to band together. And if I had to talk about anything that in a way I find disconcerting about being in the Midwest, is I grew up in a place where you had to tell people what a Lutheran was. And when I was a pastor in New England, which was so heavily Roman Catholic, I remember I went into a nursing home one time to commune one of my aged Finnish parishioners, and there were these girls from a Catholic high school there who were doing some, you know, visits and stuff, and one of them looked at me and said, geez, are you a priest or is that a put-on? And I thought, Lord, those are the options. Those are her options. And he's saying, how many people go trick-or-treating as a cross-dressing priest in a nursing home? I mean, does this seem likely? But I realized there's just no category here. And so that what I found is, I mean, my major support system, we had to be, I worked with all the other pastors in the town because there was only one of each of us. And when I took it out to the Midwest, I was astonished. I the whole idea of shopping for congregations, nobody shopped for a Lutheran congregation in Annapolis, Maryland. There was one. There was this one, and there was a Missouri Synod one. The choice was rather clear, you know. But here, suddenly, I had like 15 churches within, you know, a couple mile radius. And it was just very distressing for me to be. So the other thing is you don't really have to rub shoulders with anybody else. Or, you know, and I think that's a loss. I mean, it has its good points, but I think ecumenically, it is a kind of a loss, because I realized that my identity as a Lutheran was always formed in that context of there are a lot of people who aren't what I am. Actually, in my town, there are a lot more people who aren't what I am. You know? So what does that mean? My friend and Cicero, at the first sort of ecumenical foray for them, and these are probably the kinds of activities that many of you have important things to share with congregations, food pantries. They do that jointly. Shelters. Caring for the homeless, caring for battered women, homeless teenagers who are, you know, children who are in transition. What they have found is that they are less threatening to people if they aren't sort of ID'd with one thing, and that just in terms of resources, burnout is a problem. In terms of resources, Meals on Wheels is another one. Very often, you know, one church has the kitchen, but the people who come are from a lot of different Christian communities. Daycare centers. You would do a great service to a community that providing safe, loving places for children to be. And doing this across denominations, I found that's another one. Whether it's in one place, but who staffs it, who sustains it, and where the children come from. Communities. Recreation programs. You know, if congregations look in their communities and say, what are the needs here, and then work both together to identify them and fill them, this becomes a very kind of basic kind of ecumenical attachment in terms of a ministry of service. You know, as my friend said, who needs to agree about the Eucharist to hand out tomato soup and get a volleyball league started? You know, you right? And the one that was, I think, most striking, and this is that place of this intersection of religion and politics, which is always a problematic one in this country. It's funny, I think most Americans think that the church is supposed to stay out of these things, and I think a proper reading of the Constitution is that the church is not supposed to have any kind of dominant voice, the way that often happened in the lands from which the founders of the country came, and miserable experiences, but that they're not supposed to be silent. We have to compete with other groups with other ideas, but we have a place in this realm. And indeed, I remember one time a representative from a social service organization spoke to my congregation. It was budget time, and people were going bananas about the money going to benevolence because it was being used for certain things that they felt were too political. And well, we'll go through this. But what this person pointed out, he said, you know, many times the legislators on whatever level, city council, up into the state legislature and beyond, are grateful for the church groups because we live in a system that works by representation. And alas, that means, frankly, if you can buy it for long hours, loud mouths, and slick programming, you got a better shot. Poor people, people with certain kinds of debt, I mean, marginal people, don't have the money for good lobbying and PR. It's just that simple, and they frequently don't have the time. Okay? And so what these legislators said, that when you come and speak to us, you help us to keep in mind all the voices we need to consider in making a judgment. And if they're silent, frankly, they just fall out. Now that to me was very compelling. There is a task that's not violating boundaries, it's actually respecting the way the governmental system here is supposed to work. They fall through the cracks. That's right. They've just, and the kind of sensitive saying, how can we think through this? How would this piece impact here? What might we do? And so the way this friend of mine, who believe me, she's pretty conservative on this, and she laughs that somehow or other the new breath of life in her ministry has come through political action, she said, is one of God's greater ironies. But in the town where she lived, the way all this started is, it's very, it's in Cicero, you know, Cicero, Illinois. Charming spot. And no, there were no really public parks. There were really, and the one that was there had been sort of closed up for years. One of the big employers had had it, but when they closed down, Western Electric, then it's a, now, these, the people were thinking, we need some place for children to play. They just, they, now what happened was, one of the big grocery store chains was going to open a grocery store, and they were going to take over part of that property and use it as a parking lot. And what people were concerned about was it was very close to a school, that they would have huge semis coming in to unload where there would be young children. And they were just appalled. You can't do anything to make it a park, suddenly you can turn it into a huge grocery, you know. And they felt helpless because it was pretty clear that, that the system was working as usual and money was changing hands. And this was a good deal. And the way it began was that people in the churches, Roman Catholic, Protestant, of various ilks, Lutheran, Methodist, right? Started. They all had kids. They all didn't like this. And they got together kind of in a session to complain. And it grew from there. And now it has its sort of own standing. And they have attended. They have had to fight for that park 3 different times. But the last time I visited her, we went by and I said, wow, look, they've got, you know, big stone turtles and stuff outside for the kids to play on. The building that's unsafe, they're sitting money aside to make it safe again and have a place indoors, little by little. And it has been plainly and simply the church people. Okay? And finally, they hired a community organizer. Now, where has that led? That's the thing I want to say, is that kind of joint action that looks out for the welfare of the neighbor. That pays attention to who might be in need, you see, and they just crossed lines. It did not matter to them whether you showed up at Mary Queen of Heaven on Sunday or not. The interesting thing is from that, she said, here was a safe, I mean, wait, they get to know each other. They work together on boards, they meet, they cross paths, and she said, you know, you love this. The Lutherans are the group that are known as have the best parties. She said, so whenever the Lutherans are going out for pizza, all the Mary Queen of Heaven people want to come. I mean, I just found it really sort of touching in a way. So the town is beginning to notice that lines are being crossed that had never been crossed before. I mean, in terms, and she said, when somebody who was involved in this group, their one of their parents died, she said, you wouldn't have believed who showed up at the funeral. Okay. In terms of, so the bond is there. And it isn't without problems, but I'll tell you, I thought one of the best pieces is old Diane. my friend Diane was almost elected as a secretary of the Catholic clergy group. Because she's so involved with this and has gotten to know them all, they just take her to their regular Bible studies and stuff. And she had such good administrative skills that they thought she'd be a good organizer. She said, we've hosted them. They have met at her church. Her ladies have come down and prepared breakfast for her. I said, Di, this is just incredible. She said, I never would have envisioned it. The younger priests, of course, are more comfortable with it, but she told me one day when they were driving from something, the very elderly priest who is the head of the staff at the one said to her, he said, well, you know, said, we're doing a lot of stuff here together. He said, I think it's about time we started thinking about. I would love it. See, one of the other priests said to her afterwards, we told you to wear a collar, Johnson. Aren't you glad we made you wear your collar that day? You know, we're helping you dress for success in these circles. And so what I'm saying is, it doesn't always work this way, but those are the things that can come out of it. And so out of then these contacts, now maybe it would work the other way. Maybe people begin with Bible studies and then move to action. Or maybe they start in some kind of community thing and say, gosh, maybe it's time we talked about praying together. But certainly other places, we do this within our congregations, but think where you work, where you live, you have people in your, you know people who aren't what you are. What would it be then to mix a group in a prayer group, right? In a study group, Bible studies, or studying things that come out of your denominations, your congregations together. I think a big piece is worship hospitality. When I was in my parish, I realized my parishioners were dying to get into other people's churches. I mean, I'm sure they were the kind, when they came over to my place for dinner or something, they went and looked through my medicine cabinet. I mean, they just wanted to know what those other churches were like. So we set up a Lenten series and went around, and the attendance was phenomenal. The attention span in a service was sometimes not so great, because they looking in a, look what they got in the pew, look at this, look how this looks different, how do they do what they do. But I think not only these special services, we do them on Good Friday, we often do them at Lent, Thanksgiving is a great time, but what would it be to start the context to invite people and say, hey, prayer and praise at our place on Pentecost 12. this is, come to a everyday service. Go to others. Not to say, we're going to be, but to know what it's like. What does this community look like? How do they worship? And that, then I think the next question is, if one begins to share scripture and to share praise and service, is a very fundamental question for Christians, and that is, what about outreach? We all live in communities where the biggest problem is not that we don't cross lines, it's that these people haven't entered any of these doors. They haven't darkened any of these thresholds. And then I think this piece of ecumenical cooperation becomes a very serious one. Because we think, what does it mean to be ecumenical and evangelical? And that's the piece I think we have to really work on. What does it mean to help people come to Christ and enter into a Christian community and know that it may not be mine, but like the angels in heaven, I have reason to rejoice if they found a place that's home. And this is another piece. This has been really interesting to me. I told you that this town where my friend is working is heavily Hispanic. And the ELCA has begun a Spanish-speaking ministry. And that congregation meets in her congregation. But one of the things that was really striking to me was before it was done, she spent a great deal of time talking to the priests who were there and say, what is this going to mean? How do you feel about this? How can we work this out? And interestingly enough, they're swamped. These priests are swamped in terms of the sheer numbers. And they said, it will be a great help to us. There have been difficulties. There are some people, of course, who because of divorce or other issues, no longer feel either, maybe it's welcome or maybe it's comfortable in a Roman Catholic church. And to say that they will find a home here was not threatening or unacceptable to them. In fact, she said, interestingly enough, just between us, because I'm sure that I don't know how the bishop would feel, but the Franciscans in particular she worked with have both come and received Eucharist at her church. And it was Leanne.
One of the things that we did is to recognize the fact that there were a lot of Catholic Protestant marriages. And we got a group going of engaged couples and newly married couples who were in cross-denominational marriages and had a priest and a pastor together kind of moderate these groups. And it was really well received.
Yes. I bet.
And then they requested a group for parents.
Mm-hmm. What's that going to mean for raising children? Yeah.
For parents, parents of their parents.
Oh, I see. Couples.
Married.
Yeah.
And because there's so much family, there's so many family dynamics around weddings anyway.
Yes.
And when there's a religious difference, and this may be the first time that they set foot in the Catholic Church, or the first time the Catholic set foot in the Protestant Church, to have some kind of, even a one session preparation to say, this is what to expect, let's take a little tour of the sanctuary and look at the wedding service and see how they're the same.
Right, and probably I think there would be a great case for an invitation to come to worship beforehand, to say, come, see what this is like here, how we generally do things. And that's really good. And that's to say, I think you've got those kinds of pieces. To think, I mean, the other thing is, I know your time is limited. Say somewhere, I mean, you could load up the things. When you make these decisions about, this is the time I have to give to some community service or work, you might think, how might I combine my call sort of to Christian service with an opportunity to expand my horizons in terms of working with a group or with people who are not just who you are denominationally. And think that, as I say, in the end, I think the big question is this one, is how do we hold ecumenism and evangelism together? Interesting, because what did this come out of? Ecumenism really was born out of the experience of the missionary movement, where people couldn't understand why they were being offered four or five different brands, right? But to think of those ways to work together. Now, study within your congregation. I recommended that book, 12 Tales Untold. I really think that it's over in the bookstore. I think you could find that a lot of fun. And so you could do it with your own group. I think it would also be a terrific one to do with a mixed group. And not just say you do the case study between just people representing the two denominations involved, but people representing the span to say, well, now here's one between Orthodox and Roman Catholic. How do you, as a Methodist, what do you make of this? Because you'll not only learn about the case study, you learn a lot about yourselves and each other by talking about this other piece. We've used it some at school with great success. And it calls for some brainstorming. How would you resolve this? What would be ecumenically helpful and pastorally sensitive, see, and doctrinally fair? That way you've got to balance those things. Ecumenical study documents. I've mentioned to you the number of pending ecumenical agreements. There are study documents for all of them. They are not written for esoteric experts. So don't think, I'll never get this. It's not so. They are for the assembly to vote on, and I think you could pick up some of those and really find that would make an interesting adult class or study group during the week or whatever. Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, a document that came out of the Faith and Order Commission of the World Council of Churches. It is probably the preeminent ecumenical document in who was involved, and it takes up those three areas that are the most controversial or controverted among Christians. And what's helpful is it lays out what everybody's position is. So that would be one you might really find helpful to sit down and read. I'm stunned. I mean, it goes back to, 1980-something? I'm just surprised at how little known it is. Considering how long it's been around. Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. And it's also, I'm just blanking, BEM is obviously the acronym. It's also called the something agreement about the place where it was, and I'm just blanking where they settled, where it was drawn up. But your pastor would know that one, and any Augsburg Fortress store would. When you do these things, when you talk about, say, either an ecumenical document or a case study, think about inviting, say, the priest from the Episcopalian Church or the minister from the UCC Church and say, now, these are some questions we have coming up. How do you think about your tradition? Also, let them respond to it. What do you think of this as an ecumenical proposal? What gives you problems? About coming into communion with us. It's sometimes hard for Lutherans to imagine that this might be an unappetizing prospect for people on the other side, but there usually are reservations both ways. And then sometimes just asking, you get a presenter from a tradition to come and talk to you. Well, what, as an Eastern Orthodox priest, what would you want to tell people about Orthodoxy? And just let them speak for it. And I think you will often find that, as long as you don't schedule it on Sunday morning, that they're really receptive to that. They're very happy to do it, to make the contact and be known. Common sense cautions. I'll only offer a few. Always distinguish between the type and the reality. One terrible thing about an historian and being a student is, much like literary types, There's the classic type, and no reality actually fulfills it in all its specificity. Don't be like I sometimes want to say, oh, well, if you feel that way, you're not really a Mennonite. You don't know them better than they know themselves. Be prepared for those surprises. To say that a community, listen, I mean, you know, you scratch too many Lutherans and ask for an explanation of the real presence. It's as one of my colleagues put it, it's not a pretty picture. It's not. All right, so what I'm saying is that there's that level. There's also, tell me about your story. Why are you a Christian? Why does your family do, what does this mean for you? And ask questions. How do you think about this? How does your church do this? Just even, how did you come to be a member of this congregation? Has your family always been Baptist? Has, you know, what has your pilgrimage been like? These are the stories that sustain us. Coming from others as they bear witness and learning about it. And I would also say, don't always avoid the scandal of division. I think one of the tendencies about ecumenism is to try to make it as positive as possible, that we're really doing a lot better. Sometimes we need to be reminded that the divisions are harsh and painful and scandalous. One of the first sessions I talked about the time my best friend's father was killed in an auto accident, and we went to the funeral mass. And he was a very popular and influential person in the community, and all sorts of people were there for the funeral. And at the end of the homily and everything, the priest stood up and said, all Roman Catholics are invited to receive. Right? And to say, but we love Tony too. We believe, you know, that, and I'm not faulting the Roman Catholic, I'm just saying, to be reminded that the barriers are there. In the Orthodox dialogue, one of the most powerful ones for me was when we met in Moscow. I'm on the International Lutheran Orthodox Dialogue. The Americans arranged to present an honorary degree to the bishop of the Lutheran Church in what was the Soviet Union. And he traveled to Moscow to receive it, and we held a service, you know, there's a Eucharistic service, and all the Orthodox came, representatives, and they stood around the back of the room for the presentation, I think. And when we exchanged the peace, they came among us and hugged and shook hands and everything, and then they went back to the wall and they didn't receive the Eucharist. Right? Because they couldn't. Teaching. And I kept thinking, if you can be reconciled to me as my brother, and I say that specifically because they all were, now, why can't we be at this table together? And it hurt. Right? So what I'm saying is, sometimes that's a good one to make us think again and think how to move forward. Don't minimize it. Also, you're whatever you are for a reason, and they're good reasons. I mean, to say, I see things this way, and I think it's important, and that's why I hold with my tradition. Don't feel that you have to deny it or back off it or whatever. I mean, let it be an open sharing. And finally, I guess the one here, as in every realm of our lives as Christians, is trust the Spirit. You have to trust the Spirit. One of my students and friend who's a pastor in a small town, telling me that when he called on the clergy in this little town he went to, when he went to the door of the Wisconsin Synod pastor, he wouldn't open it. He would only talk to him through the screen. And I say, this is fear. This is fear, and perfect love casts out fear. If you can't trust the Spirit enough to think that you can walk amongst others without being tainted, without your faith being taken from you, then you're not really, I don't want to put it in blame, you know, but part of but being a Christian is being free to walk on the wild side, you know? And as we say, enter into this with this belief that the Spirit brings out of these encounters a deeper love, a deeper truth. Right, so I'll stop there. Comments, questions, what has your experience been? What do you folks do in your towns?
Congregation and volunteers mm-hmm. shares the physical facilities of the Catholic mm-hmm. church. So the West Side Annex, if you would, of St. Michael's. parish. There's, I think, I look at that as a mission or as a community activity, but there are some that feel threatened by their presence.
Do you know, I think they are one of the case studies written up in that book, 12 Tales Untold. I think it might be the same one, because it was in the Pacific Northwest about a shared, Catholic and Lutheran.
About 5 years ago, they had a building program, and as far as we know now, they still don't have any evidence of that happening, and there are people who wonder if they're going to be there.
Forever.
But anyway, I've looked at it as a very positive thing, and we have a lot of interchange, at least among the people, even if it isn't in the services. They help with the groundskeeping and the other projects.
Joint committees. You know, I mean, that if you're sharing space, you certainly both have a... property committees. Yeah, Penny.
I think that we also have to be careful or make sure that when we state an invitation to community, that it's very definite that all believing Christians are invited. Because so many of us come from traditions in which that church only allowed that church. And we know everybody else came from similar traditions. That unless you know the policy that church, you're not going to put yourself forward. And I was home for communion one time after I chose to be a Lutheran, not a Baptist. And it was communion Sunday, and I refused to take it that day because the way it was stated was very muddy. And we discussed it afterward. Mother was appalled that I didn't realize. I said, Mother, when Dad invited people, he did not say all believers. I mean, it's maybe some variation that's similar, but it wasn't a real clear-cut statement. And I think that's something we really need to be aware of. Because when you're inviting a Catholic, they know that when you go to the Catholic church, you're not going to be able to take. Therefore, can they take in your church? Yes, it becomes a very...
Well, and the other thing is to know that you hit double, because the obstacle may well be not what your church may invite them, but they not, their own church may make them. And let me say, this, what was striking about this was that if my friend's father had been buried out of the other, they would probably let us commune. See that? Now, the thing cuts both ways. I don't mean to fault this priest. I also want to say that as a Protestant there, or non-Catholic, whoever was there, I think a number of them weren't sure what they were supposed to do. And frankly, his clarity wasn't taken by everybody as sort of like, wham! It was sort of like, okay, thanks. Because we don't want to offend. We don't want to offend by staying in our seats.
You don't know for sure exactly who's invited.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really...
And this is part of this hospitality issue that it's a little bit, I think, about, we sit at home and now, after you've been here a little while, you know, I mean, you could start doing what you're supposed to do with your silverware and stuff before they even say anything, okay? And you know it. I mean, it's like the second time you do garbology, you know what has a high rubber content, has to be buried. But the first time you're like, what do I do with this? You know? I think that the part we have to think about in worship lots of times is how many people come who simply don't have a clue. And we still work on old assumptions that everybody does. Now, little by little, they'll get into it. But I think my father's great direction to me, I don't know whether I followed it or not, but I had a terrible time my first year teaching. My students just looked absolutely mystified all the time, and I thought I had indeed missed my calling. And my father said, Jane, you can never be too elemental. Now, I also think that's great for the sacrament. But the fact is that... Think about that. When people come in, you just can't be too elemental. It's you know, in terms of saying, this is what we're going to do, and do you understand that you're welcome? And I do agree, Candy, that the time when you could print it in the bulletin and think people would read it and say, I guess that applies to me. I think it needs to be probably spoken, yes, that for them to...
Because by the time you finish looking through the book anyway, I'm trying to keep up for the people who are adults.
And maybe one of those things about inviting people, you know, from other churches would help you. Also helps you begin to see it through somebody else's eyes, where they go, well, boy, you could have knocked me over with a feather when you guys started. Why'd you do that? You know, I wasn't ready for that. There's a hand over here.
Well, in our church, the statement is all are welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
And we had a family that we had helped immigrate from, Vietnam. Here were these Buddhists that came to the table and were welcome. And they're not even Christian.
See, you get to be a case study too, or something similar about that, and precise about the question of, do you require baptism? You know, I mean, but should you? What do you, and these are pieces, let me say, that ecumenically, that there would be some of our ecumenical brothers and sisters would be very upset by them. And so what I also want to say is this, ecumenism doesn't just mean opening. I mean, it gets you into some very awkward things, because they're like, well, if A and B are friends, well, if you're going to be my friend, then you can't do that with C. Because that's not true to the faith or whatever, so it can get sticky. But I think, but one of the things would be, at least we talk about it. Why would it be sticky? Why will you not be comfortable with our doing that? What is it about your teaching or practice that makes that difficult? And let me tell you why we feel we can do that and be truly evangelical. Yes, yeah. Yes, please.
We have a daughter who married a Catholic boy in a longer Catholic church, and we commune in that church regularly whenever we're there, so.
That kind of right. Yeah, please.
Just a little bit of a humor, maybe, with his son, Fiscal Hayden, the priest, and our church is a real stickler about women with lipstick. Please remove all traces of cosmetics on your lips before coming to rest. So for the women who belong to the church regularly, we just don't wear lipstick, you know.
Oh, how again?
But for guests, you can see the
friend. All looking without lipstick.
Yes.
You have people without lipstick are welcome.
Yes. Neither that. You'll have to start putting little blotting tissues in the, you know, there with the book so they can. Yes, please.
I'm from Portland, Oregon. Our mail carrier is a minister, and he's been our mail carrier for about 5 years, and he's started, he's drawing our church into the community. We're kind of a church that's gotten real small over the years. We're in an inner city kind of location, sort of, I guess. And he came to one of our last meetings because he would like to have an evening service at our church and bring people, not even from our church, bring in. And we wanted to be a part of this, that we had enough sense to know. We wanted to be a part of this. And the last time we met, we were talking about a church picnic and where should we have it. And he's just the most gentle man coming in from this real fundamentalist background. I don't even know what church it is, but he's a prison minister. And I'm coming in, and he says, you know, what we're trying to do is get the churches to have their picnics in the park, you know, down the street, and we're taking back the parks. And so we decided to have our picnic there, and I said, well, I really want us to have our church service out there. And so he just moves us along real gentle to open it up to the neighborhood, that the whole neighborhood association is invited to the picnic and the service. And we haven't even discussed communion. I don't know what we're going to do. Things, but we're just beginning. It's exciting, but we sure don't know all the questions yet.
Yeah.
And he's been real patient with us.
Well, one of my colleagues has said that the chief pastoral, and I was going to say this always, a chief Christian virtue is patience. You know, remember, somebody was talking about, this was about negative behaviors, was that it? I think it was, that that as long as it took them to come into place, it will take that long to undo them. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't like to think our time span is quite that grim. But these divisions and the misunderstandings have grown up over a long, long time. So, it's going to take a while. They're going to take a while. But I think, I feel confident in saying, we have crossed a threshold that we will never be able to go back. And as an historian, you see, I read some of the things that were written at the beginning of this century, and I think, Nobody would talk about the Roman Catholic. And you wouldn't. You would not get up in a classroom and say that kind of thing. Right? So that's what I mean. In faith is always this venture, as Luther says, sort of suspended over the void. I mean, you don't know. That's why it's not always ecumenical sort of doublespeak, that they won't tell you exactly what they're trying to accomplish, because in some ways we don't know. Like I said about a relationship, we don't know at the beginning where relationships will take us, or that in times of great joy that there may yet be times of great grief ahead, you know? But that's what we've begun, with a different sense of partnership. And so I wish you the best. For one humor, so then let me answer. You had a hand up. One of my friends was commenting that he thought a good ecumenical strategy would be when they put together the church softball and basketball leagues, that instead of doing it by congregations, you had to pick members so that you had ecumenical teams. I know you're ever thinking, oh, that's an interesting idea. You know, that you don't just play with the gang, but you. So I don't know whether he. I thought part of it was because the Eastern Orthodox were just creaming them every year, that they probably wanted to break up the Chicago Bulls powerhouse, sort of, you know. We had Leanne, you had.